No, I know, but it was kind of right. Okay, thank you very much for coming back so promptly, and apologies that actually we didn't start, even though you were all ready. So I apologise for that. We have, as you can see, a distinguished panel to discuss progressive conservatism. I'm just going to ask each of the panellists to make some very, very brief opening remarks on what they see as progressive conservatism. One of the panellists, I don't know whether I haven't asked permission to say who it is yet, one of the panellists says, I'm not progressive or a conservative. Is that a problem? I'll leave you to guess who it was. And I said, that's no problem at all. That's exactly the kind of angle we need to be covered by the panel. So I'll very briefly introduce the panel. They will then speak, and then obviously we'll just open it up to the floor. If I could ask you to keep your questions very short, and obviously to the panel as well, to say that there may be some questions that are more relevant for other panelists and yourselves. Don't feel the need to answer every question, because otherwise we'll only have one or two before we break for a drink of five. So from your left, as you look at the panel, John Cruddas, the MP for Dagenham, and the highest polling candidate for the Labour deputy leadership in the first round. Who has been reported to have turned down various offers of ministerial jobs in order to retain his independence on Labour's back benches. Next to him, Oliver Letwin, who is in charge of policy for the Conservative Party, and I think one of the red Tories that the Prospect article is referring to, but I'll leave that for him. Philip Blond, you know already. On his left, Professor John Gray, Professor Emeritus now of London School of Economics, author of a number of works, including Straw Dogs, and his next book shortly out. When's it out, John?
3 months, in March.
In March is a series of essays entitled Grey's Anatomy. And on his on his left, which is not what you think, and on his left, Will Hutton, who is the Executive Vice Chair of the Work Foundation, who was recently described in the Evening Standard as one of the closest aides to Gordon Brown, before he went on to describe the British economy as resembling Iceland on Thames. With friends like these. John.
Thanks, Richard. I'll be quite brief, but partly because I'm here because I was so taken with the top speakers here this afternoon, because I'm a massive fan of Philip, as well as I'm very interested in David. But I'm very interested in this debate around compassionate conservatism, or progressive conservatism, as you're describing it. Myself and Jonathan Rutherford, who's the editor of Soundings, a journal, we did an e-book which cost £560 to do, which is a collection of essays on what compassionate or progressive conservatism was, and those 25,000 of them got downloaded in a very short space of time. So there's a really, really massive space for a proper discussion about this. And when I think about it, I think of two essays. On the one hand, Why I'm Not a Conservative by Hayek, right? On the other, On Being Conservative by Oakeshott, right? And those two different streams, should we say, the liberal tradition, and let's call it a paternalistic tradition, and that is very uneasy. And I thought it was quite uneasy in terms of some of the responses given to some of the questions about the individual and the community that came out of the audience in the first session that we might want to return to. The problem is, 15th of September 2008, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers go into Chapter 11, and this debate sort of preceded it about compassionate conservatism, and it sort of stopped since then. Before then, they'd occupied the terrain around fraternity, criticised the left for being preoccupied with equality instead of fraternity, and indeed the right, who were preoccupied with liberty instead of fraternity as well, and they allowed them to talk about relationships, empathy, care, human relationships as part of that decontamination of conservatism, and I thought that was a really, really strong movement there. The question is, has that been maintained since 15th of September 2008? And I'd question whether it has, because the premise of a lot of the compassionate conservative discussion was the assumption that all the outstanding issues of economics had been settled, okay? And they never really got to some of the fundamentals around rationality and economic behaviour, the purity of market exchange, atomised individualism, etc., etc., which were teased out in some of the questions earlier on. So I think it's brittle now. I think it is a really interesting philosophical movement, and I think it throws up real dangers for the Labour Party, who have vacated that terrain of ethical socialism, has become sort of mechanistic and utilitarian in its approach to public policy making, which allows the conservatism to occupy space that we have also to inhabit as well. So I think it's a fascinating philosophical debate, question mark about whether the economics has meant that David, etc., have hit the rewind button and away from this terrain, which if they take and carry on, I think will be very difficult for us to challenge at the moment. One final point. I was at a meeting recently with a load of people who are in the Christian Socialist movement. And all they wanted to talk about was the work of Ian Duncan Smith around the social justice, and the issues that he was dealing with, And that said an awful lot that a lot of our youngest, active, most vibrant, ethical socialists wanted to talk about the work of Ian Duncan Smith. And I think that was quite a tell about the terms of political debate at the moment and was more a critique of us than we have so far acknowledged to date.
Thank you. Thanks, John. Ola, there is this point, isn't it, about the fact that it was defined socially and that it was the Progressive Conservatives about not being the party of economics anymore and being obsessed with economics, and instead it was going to fix society in the social recession, but that was before the economic crisis. So perhaps you'll talk to that, whether or not the recession's done for that aspect of Progressive Conservatives.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting thing to talk about. I'm delighted to hear what John says about the group of Christian Socialists and Ian Duncan Smith. And of course I accept that the remarkable events of the last few months have meant that everybody's talking, well, anyway, everybody in Westminster and the newspapers and so on, is talking about technical economics and all sorts of things that have relatively little to do with anything that I hope anybody's been talking about today so far or will talk about now. And when the news agenda does that, then everybody starts having to follow it to a degree, and it's inevitable. But I think we're actually just about to be past that stage, not in the sense that the problems are not very deep, not in the sense they don't need dealing with, and goodness knows, not in the sense that there isn't going to be a lot of human misery to come, and that it will also have to be relieved as far as possible. But in the sense that actually what happens to these news agendas is that eventually the journalists get, just as they get incredibly interested in it for a while, they get incredibly bored by it eventually. And we will move back to talking about much wider concerns. And I mean, actually, I think it's quite interesting that this discussion is happening today. I think it's about the time when people are beginning to think that there are actually going to go on being all sorts of other things to talk about. So I think that the interesting question is not whether that theme has been obscured politically, which, of course, for a period it has, but I don't think it will continue to be, but rather whether it's posed a sort of fundamental problem for the direction of thought that David will have been talking about earlier and that we're going to talk about now. And my answer is actually not only that it hasn't posed a fundamental problem, but actually much deeper, much more important point, I think it's brought into high relief the need for this sort of discourse, because our view is that the underlying causes of the problems we are now facing go much deeper than just sort of monetary economics. Of course, these technical things matter. But actually, underneath that, there's the question of how do people live? What's society like? Is our economy built on social foundations that have strength and resilience because they're decentralized and diversified? Or is it all located in a place where it's very vulnerable because it's not built on those kinds of social foundations? And I mean, I'm sure Philip is going to want to talk more, and I know he has already talked. I didn't hear his talk. I have a sort of sense of what was likely to have been in it. Talked about the extent to which building communities can build much more resilient and much stronger economies that don't suffer this kind of, I don't know, aren't so inclined to suffer this kind of very sharp volatility. And I think also that the human misery that we are already beginning to see multiply and will, I fear, see more of in coming months indicates much more clearly than one would have thought when everything was said to be going so well just how important the underpinning of society is. And anybody who thinks that we're going to solve the kinds of problems that are going to emerge in the medium term from what we're going through now just in terms of either the market or just in terms of state action, I think is deluded. I think there's an awful lot of what's going on now that's going to have to be cured by family and by community. And a lot of what we need to do, therefore, is highly relevant to this debate. The last thing I'd say is I think it's a very remarkable fact, and I think that this is a kind of totem, that at our party conference in October, when we were being told by all the gurus, the media gurus that inevitably talk to political parties, that we had to focus exclusively on the economy, we actually chose that moment very consciously to bring out our proposals for high-speed rail and for not having Heathrow. Why did we do this? Because we wanted to make the point that we had not lost track of agendas that are fundamental to progressive conservatism and don't fit naturally with moments of crisis. And it was with the same intent that we just recently brought out our low carbon economy paper, green paper, because we wanted to indicate that we had not lost track of these things. And in addition, and perhaps even more importantly, I think it's very noticeable that both we and, rather more saliently in the press just recently, Obama, have located part of the way out of the current crisis as lying in a greener economy and in the technologies which will support that and in the jobs which can be generated by the technologies which support that and so on. So, you know, if you ask yourself the question, did the modern progressive Conservative Party sort of immediately resile from one important part of this agenda, which is the green agenda, when we hit economic rocks? The answer is no. On the contrary, we have highlighted it. And I don't say that that means that there are no difficulties in pursuing this agenda through great economic turbulence. There are. But I think it's a sign of the intent to continue with this because we think it's right, because we think it's something which can unite and bring people together, and I admit, because we think it does pose a problem for the Labour Party. We think it changes the terms of trade of political debate, and that's part of the point of having a political party, to lead the debate.
Thank you, Oliver. Philip, would you mind, just for the benefit of your fellow panellists who perhaps weren't here, giving the kind of one-minute summary of your view?
The one-minute long.
The one-minute, 30 seconds, the elevator pitch for Blondism.
I think that the task for the Conservatives is to restore a modern version of medievalism. And by that I mean the following.
I thought it was the 18th century.
It is, but hear me out.
Yeah. You're going backwards.
By this I mean the following.
The rewind button.
What's interesting is you all laugh.
Yeah.
But what marked the Middle Ages was a huge variety of degrees of property ownership. There weren't just absolute property rights and then people owning nothing. There were degrees of property relationship. Some people owned something completely, then they owned something else in part with others, then they owned something for a certain period of time, then they had duties of service somewhere else, and then they had a huge range and diversity of property relationships. In short, that economy, through that diversity, was prevented from forming a monopoly. One of the reasons we have the current crisis is we have monopoly finance. All of our wealth is essentially engendered through one system that's been state-sanctioned, not least because the state withdrew from the economy and withdrew capital controls, and also then state finance, since in America, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac underwrote the mortgage securities that followed therefrom. So we've had a monological monopoly of mortgage finance, and when you have a monopoly, you have security supply issues, and it just took one person somewhere to not pay, the whole system collapsed. Restoring varieties and degrees of ownership introduces the idea that if one aspect fails, the others won't. There are firewalls between different degrees of ownership, firewalls between different economies. We need local capital, we need regional capital, we need national capital, and of course we need international capital. Restoration of all these, the notion of tiered markets tied to social outcomes, will produce several goods: a plurality of ownership, a plurality of security, and a conservative version of Polanyi, I can never pronounce his name, thesis in The Great Transformation, embedding economy back in society. And that's what I mean, and that's kind of the oddly hyper-modern version that, in part, I'd like to restore.
Thank you, Philip. John.
Well, looking back as far as Philip has done to the Middle Ages reminded me of something that an earlier generation of progressive conservatism articulated as to the nature of progress. It's a brief story. Some of you may know it already. Stanley Baldwin, at the end of his life, gave a talk in Cambridge, at the end of which he was asked if he'd ever had any governing ideas. Now, anyone who knew anything about his career would have doubted that he had any that he was inspired by ideas. But to anyway, everyone's amazement, he said he did, and that when he was a young man, he'd read a book by Sir Henry Maine called Ancient Liberty. It's Ancient Law, excuse me. It's still in print, which had represented human history as a grand progression, a grand progress from societies based on command and obedience to societies based on contract and consent. And he went on to say that throughout his political career whenever he had a really difficult conundrum to resolve, a difficult dilemma, he consulted this idea, this wonderful idea, which he imbibed in his childhood. And he ended by saying, so my entire life has been informed by political life by this idea of human history as a progressive movement from status and command and obedience to a world of contract and consent and liberty. And then he paused and said, or was it the other way around? So, I mean, the message is grand visions of progress, grand conceptions of progress come and go. But I think what we're seeing now is a very interesting moment in British political life. This is the most lively as well as the most fundamental conversation, I think, which is going on at the moment. And I think progressive conservatism is rapidly evolving. And I think one of the reasons it's rapidly evolving was given by John Cruddas, which is that it was formulated initially really on Thatcherite, Blairite ground before the dislocation in the global economy. And I think while it's true, again, as Oliver has said, that many elements of that will not be necessarily pushed into the shadows by this crisis. They remain valid because whatever the solutions come up, they can't only be economic solutions to economic problems. I think there is there are a series of strategic or structural or even intellectual issues that progressive conservatives need to address, which actually arise partly from or even mainly from the economic crisis. And I'll just mention a couple and then stop. One is that the effect of the crisis so far has been a huge expansion of state power, not just in Britain, and not for ideological reasons, but also, and even more obviously, in America, where it certainly wasn't driven. Paulson is no ideologist. These are pragmatic people who are confronted with an imminent heart attack, as some of them put it, in the global banking system, and therefore had to do what they did. They expanded the state on a huge scale. The same things happened in Britain. Maybe the Republicans were in America were more reluctant to do it, but they had to do it. Brown might have been less reluctant to do it. It might have squared with some statist instincts, but he had to do it anyway and wouldn't have done it otherwise. It's the logic of events. It's not ideology. It's the logic of events. And so what will be inherited by the next government will be a gigantic state, probably by then, if there is much more full-scale nationalization of the banking system, in substantial control of the commanding heights of financial life in this country. That will be the situation they actually inherit. And I wonder then, as it were, whether the, so to speak, anti-statist, pluralist, organicist, hyper-modern medievalist aspect of progressive conservatism can really make much headway in that context. Because this kind of expansion is not only for a few weeks or a few months. It won't be forever, because we will see our way through these problems. We will muddle through more or less intelligently, and something will come out at the end. It's not going to last forever. But I think it's going to be for quite a while. And my two final points are this. One is kind of more philosophical point, and the other is less so. I think there is a sort of a philosophical issue about the role of the state here. And the philosophical issue is this. In the Thatcher period, the state grew in strength and became more invasive as a consequence of its anti-statist project. As I say, the idea was that by limiting overmighty intermediary associations, particularly the trade unions, you would have a better society. There was also limiting overmighty local authorities. The consequence was a large expansion of state power as a sort of unintended consequence of the Thatcher project. To some extent, that went on under Blair, and it's carried on under Brown. And we all are aware of the difficulties, the problems, the dangers, the risks, the inefficiencies even, the inefficacy of a lot of that state. But it's come about, again, from the unintended consequence, the logic of events. Can we actually move from that situation to a situation in which there is a massive, radical, extensive devolution of resources and powers to communities? Well, I'll just raise these two issues. One issue is, as it were, a moral or a philosophical issue. I'm very sympathetic to criticisms of libertarian conservatism, because I think it's an oxymoron, actually. in many ways, which say that the individual, the individual was thought of in the Thatcherite period, is a kind of an unreal abstraction. Very sensitive. I'm very sympathetic to that. But, and it's a sort of important but, we have to realize that communities can be repressive, both of smaller communities within them and of individuals. And we also need to recognize that communities can come into conflict with each other on important issues where they have radically different views of sex, birth, death, censorship, etc. And that when that happens, who holds the ring? What holds the ring? The state. So the state's there, I think, all along. The state actually not only is going to be, is already and will be a dangerously, if you like, overextended and dominant institution in society, but it's also going to be necessary to resolve issues of the kind I've mentioned about the position of individuals and small groups within larger communities, which might turn out to be repressive of them. And there's a second and last reason, which is to whom or to what will most voters and most people look for protection against the storm? And remember, one of the things about the protection against the storm is it's in a country which is not only heavily indebted, and that may be the fault of the government, that it's as indebted as it is, but it's the most, probably the most globalized economy in the world, much more so than the Americans, and smaller. It's extremely widely open. So one of the kind of issues is what institution can shelter people, protect people, get them back to work, give them the opportunities they want in a context of disorderly globalization. Because although everyone will talk about the need for much more international cooperation and blah, 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 and we all think it's absolutely wonderful, I wouldn't count on it myself. And I wouldn't base policies on those kinds of hopes. I would at least have contingency policies, not for the worst situation, not for collapse and disaster and the end of the world, but for a relatively high degrees of international conflict, which we've already seen over issues of energy in the Ukraine and elsewhere. We've already seen that against this background, what happens as states act. So in this context, I think the state actually is going to be looked to as a source of, as a protector. And any political project, let alone political philosophy, but any political project which sort of excessively attacks or diminishes the role of the state in protecting people hasn't got much future. Even so far, what was it that killed off Scottish nationalism, or at least for the time being, or that pulled its sting? It was the example of small states, Ireland, Iceland, buffeted by these vast globalized forces. Now, what could communities do against, unless we shut ourselves off, which, as a critic of recent types of globalization, I don't think is possible, what can we do actually to prevent this, this nation of 60 million or so people being buffeted by these global trends? We actually can't insulate ourselves. Not only are we the most globalized, but we'll probably continue to be highly globalized, probably should even do, because it'd be too many losses to if that was rolled back. So I think this issue of the role and function of the state is very important, because the reason the banking system didn't collapse in Britain was that the reserve powers of the state were there and were used. Whatever mistakes were made, and I'm sure there were many, and whatever dangerous position we're now in terms of overborrowing, potential sterling runs, and et cetera, which, from what I can guess from people who are in the markets that I know, are real risks, it was actually the reserve powers of a big modern state that kept the show on the road.
Thank you. Thanks. Will, I was in the office of a senior conservative the other day, and there was a book on the bookshelves that I think was 15 years old now, called The State We're In, and I sort of pointed it out that it was on there, and it was well thumbed, and an unnamed conservative said, "Yes, we're turning to that quite a lot now." So, although you're a close aide to Brown, you're also a progressive conservative before your time. Perhaps is that a label that you're comfortable with? Or?
Well, there's echoes out there of a stakeholding society and things that Phillips talks about. Yeah, I mean, God, I think the first thing to say is that. It's important that David Cameron said today that he wants a society that's fair, where we help people out of poverty and help them stay out of it for life. Important that he said he wants a society where opportunity is equal and where everyone can write their own life story. He wants one that's greener and he wants one that's safer. And these seem to me to be, speaking from where I sit in the political spectrum, I'd much rather have a leader of the Conservative Party saying those things than he wants to further promote labour market flexibility, reduce trade union power, lower taxation on the top, deregulate the City of London, and the other kinds of things that have been part of the Conservative Manifesto, and recognisably part of the Conservative Manifesto over the last 30 years. And it's the important thing is that I think members of the Conservative Party, as much as opposition parties, John, I think need to recognise that there is a big change going on within the Conservative Party. And it's also it's actually brave of David Cameron, because I don't think there are a lot of people who are unreconstructed and will regard this move and setting these priorities with a great deal of suspicion. It's likely that the Tory party, given the current opinion polls, are probably going to form the next government, much better that its leader and leadership kind of champion these aims than some of the aims that they championed over the last kind of period. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that, David Cameron says in his speech that he was going to leave philosophising to others. And I know from my own conversations with him and others at the top of this project that one of the reasons for that is, unfortunately, there isn't very much philosophy to support liberal conservatism. I once asked, actually, a leading liberal Tory, a number of them, for the kind of intellectual influences on them. I mean, who would it be that you would look to for a canon of theory which you might be able to support your practice? It seems to me pretty important, and he acknowledges that himself. And it's very thin, very thin. And the best answer I got was from a former chairman of the Conservative Party, who said there were three authors that he thought informed his liberal conservatism. They were Adam Smith, not The Wealth of Nations, but The Theory of Moral Sentiments. And there's quite a lot of The Theory of Moral Sentiments in what David Cameron said today. Secondly, David Hume, and with his Enlightenment scepticism. And thirdly, Henry Kissinger, with his with his commitment to rail politique. And I thought that kind of captured, in a way, where a pragmatic liberal Tory, a Ken Clark figure, wouldn't give that answer, I guess, but that's probably where he is. But the question is, and for those of us who there are very substantial literatures behind David's commitments today, and they tend to come from liberal left authors. I mean, if I was to argue, who is it who's thought hardest about writing their own life story? Well, it would be John Rawls or Amartya Sen. who's thought hardest about poverty and inequality? It would be a kind of a Richard Tawney, I think. And so and when it gets to economics, and I think it's pretty, I echo some things that John has said. I mean, the issue is not, and I think that David said in his speech, a lot of people in politics are actually for the same things, and the question is less ends but means. And how would you achieve these means, in the capitalist society in which we live in 2009? And John's kind of spelled out some of the challenges. I ran across a leading conservative about a year ago, before Lehman Brothers, who said to me, "Now remind me, Will, why were you so keen to nationalise Northern Rock?" And it was up until quite late, the instincts of very many in the Conservative leadership was to resile from the kinds of interventions that have been vital to retain the integrity of the British banking system. The Tories win in 2010, they will inherit very substantial levels of public debt and partially own banking system. And here's the big point, because actually British banks are increasing their lending. The Royal Bank of Scotland's lending is 10% higher than it was in the same period last year. The same story is true of Barclays, HSBC, and even the Lloyds Group. But here's the damn problem, is that because we were so open, picking up on John's point, about anything between a third and a half of the capacity of the British banking system has evaporated because it was done by foreign banks, Icelandic banks, Irish banks, Belgian banks, French banks, and they fled. They've repatriated their lending to their own countries and don't have the capacity to lend to us. We have a challenge. Unless we increase the capacity of the British banking system to lend, we are going to have a potentially very severe recession. The IMF say that financially reduced recessions last twice as long and are twice as deep as normal ones. And just so you have a benchmark in your head, they actually give you the numbers. They tell you that recessions that are caused by financial crises last for 8 or 9 quarters, and the average fall in GDP is 4.5%. And that's for a survey of 37 countries since 1945, nearly all of whom, of course, were having their financially induced recessions during a period of global trade growth, not like we are, when all the other G7 countries are in a recession year two. We can thus be certain that GDP will fall by 4.5% or 5% over a period of 2 years, and it may very well fall by 7 or 8%. And the only way to mitigate that and to do it rapidly is not just to do what the government has done, which I strongly support, but also to build new capacity. We probably have to construct, like Roosevelt did in the early 30s, institutions like a national infrastructure bank, a national housing bank, a long-term investment bank, to have the capacity to sustain the lending. What and who will do this in this framework that David Cameron laid out this morning? It certainly isn't going to come from Britain's villages and townships. And it is going to come, I'm afraid, from the state using its taxing power to create public institutions. Similar challenges face us in interesting, very interesting kind of debate at the moment in television. It happens that the force of globalisation, which you talk, are working themselves out here. The BBC has its licence fee. Channel 4 is being emasculated, as is Channel 5 and the ITV, by the collapsed advertising revenues. Yet, you know, foreign companies operating in this market, Sky has a revenue of £7 billion compared with the BBC's £3.5 billion licence fee, and Google have revenues, ad revenues alone in the UK of £1 billion. These are, we're not obliging them to produce content. And where in Britain's villages and delocalised, decentralised environment is one going to, how is one going to kind of have an architecture of broadcasting over the next 10 or 15 years that provides us with lots of British content to watch, programmes that we can laugh at, dramas that tell us our story. If we cede the ground to foreign multinationals and say that the only response with David later on in his speech is that when he's confronted with challenges like how are you going to reshape broadcasting, his response is going to be how little money we can spend, how can we come up with a decentralised answer, how can we solve it through individual and community initiative, how can we not have a centralised government response. Now, I think that you have to... there are big questions facing us as a national community over the next decade. We've relied very much over the last 15 years on financial services, which are 11.5% of GDP, or were in the middle of 2007, they're now rather less, and the housing market. Indeed, if you take the housing market, it's an amazing number, but if you take the housing market, equity withdrawal, and all the industries that were built around the asset price bubble, and financial services, you know, around 25% of GDP was alone came from those two sources. That is over. Completely over for, you know, the foreseeable future. House prices are likely not to return to 2007 levels until 2015 or 2017 on the basis of what we know from other countries who've been through what we've gone through, and may not get back to those levels until 2020. Unemployment is certainly going to rise, 1.5 million, maybe even more as a result of this recession. You know, how is one going to respond to this? And here I think, you know, we're going to have to build some honest-to-God businesses in some honest-to-God, you know, parts of the knowledge economy, both in services and in manufacturing, and we're going to have to build a hard and a soft infrastructure to support them. Employment systems, university systems, research systems, banking systems, training systems, management development systems. We have to rethink the way we actually constitute companies and so they can grow and employ our people so that our kids have something to do when they leave colleges and schools. There's nothing in this at all that addresses that. Nothing. it's very much a doctrine that, and the ideas that kind of come from it, that are actually built upon the prosperity we've had in the last decade.
Exactly.
And really the assumption that actually once we've navigated our way through this very difficult time of the next 18 months and 2 years, it'll come back in some way spontaneously, but it's not going to. Now, nonetheless, having said all that, you know, I mean, should a welfare system be about, you know, never-ending payments of, you know, welfare benefits to recipients who have to do little or nothing for it? How destructive has that been upon working-class family life? And who actually stands up in public and talks about it, which is a tough thing to do? Well, progressive conservatives do, and it needs to be said. Because there are... the new book I'm working on, called Sweet Justice, is an attempt to actually to kind of think through kind of principles of fairness and what a fair capitalism would look like. There are there's a story about process in fairness, there's a story about proportionality in fairness, but there's or people also have a very strong feeling that actually what is fair, you can compensate people for brute bad luck, for the accident of birth by family or by geography or town in which you were born. But if people make choices, actual choices that lead them to be in adverse circumstances, people feel it's very, very unfair to continually underwrite them through a welfare system that makes no demands on them. And actually, in fairness, in this document, there are ideas that actually come to terms with that, which actually the liberal left continually and consistently don't confront. So it's not, you know, I don't want to, I think the where I'm left with on this is that, and also I think some of the points about some of the points that both Oliver and Philip made are right. I mean, it wasn't just a story about intellectual mistakes and deregulation and all of that that led to the last to this asset price bubble. You know, we did all collude in it, and we were kind of a low savings society. There is a sense in which actually. We don't take responsibility for the actions that we collectively take. We want the state to bail us out of those consequences. And actually, I mean, it was amazing that actually I thought it was completely unbelievable when Eric Daniels of Lloyds TSB and John Varley of Barclays in October, having, you know, organised their institutions in such a way that they were, well, certainly in both cases, and in Royal Bank of Scotland's case, completely bust. Were kind of saying that it was kind of outrageous that the government, you know, wasn't acting more quickly. Of course it should be the state that comes immediately to your aid, you know, and complaining in a kind of real kind of whining tone. It was a kind of adult-child relationship. The state is the adult, we're the child, we've made a mistake, we want the money quickly to bail us out. And that kind of, that culture, which is very evident, actually, in many of our business and is also available in obvious in many of our communities, is one which I think, you know, there's a lack of grown-upness, and I think this document that David's come out with today does address that. So I think socially, this has got some interesting notions. Economically, I share exactly the same view as John Gray. I really think that over the next decade, we're going to have to use the state big time if we're to address the fundamental problems that we've got. Thanks.
Thanks, Will. Okay, I don't know everyone else. I need a couple of days to just to reflect on and recover from that. I'm sure there are things that have been said that other panellists would like to respond to, but if I could ask you to do that in the context of other questions, I'd like to get some questions flowing from the floor now as well. So I'm going to break David Cameron's rule of three and go for three again and ask the panellists not necessarily to answer. If you don't all have to answer all three, otherwise that's 15 and for each. Anyway, it'll get out of hand if you. But and if there are questions for specific panelists, then do let me know. There's a lady right at the back there, and then the two gentlemen here on this side, Sunder at the front, and then
yes. Maggie Pagano, Independent on Sunday. President Obama made a point this week, which when he said, "It's not so much whether the state is big, but whether it works or not." And I wondered whether John Gray thought that, I mean, it is clear we're going to have a huge state, whether that's actually incompatible with progressive conservatism, because clearly Obama thinks that it is.
Okay. I'd also like to out you, Maggie, as a member of the advisory board for the Progressive Conservative Project, which you didn't mention, but I'll do it anyway. Yes.
Daniel Rosenstone from Weber Shandwick. I know that in liberal and progressive liberal theory, there's a lot of talk about how to accommodate illiberal communities in liberal society. Now, from what Mr. Cameron and Mr. Blunt have said, communities obviously play a very large part in the progressive conservative agenda. So really my question is how do you further the progressive conservative agenda if you are entrusting that to communities which are certainly conservative but not in the least progressive?
Great, thank you. And then just in front of you, if you pass it forward to Sunder.
Thanks. Sunder Catwalla from the Fabians. I think this is mainly to Oliver and Philip. Progressive conservatism, obviously being conservative, would have a tradition of progressive conservatism. But I thought John opened up by mentioning Hayek and Oakeshott, and I think there's a quite big, I think, political question around the big rupture that took place within the Conservative Party and the modern right, you know, 30 or 35 years ago, because what I was reminded of was Keith Joseph's, declaration that he had thought he was a conservative, but of course he wasn't at all, and clear meaning that conservatives have gone around not being conservatives, but appeasing the Fabian LSE left and letting the ratchet effect go on. So if you were progressive conservatives, you would say, I think what Philip has said, if the right is there and is Hayekian, it is not conservative, that is a bankrupt market fundamentalist right, and that is what you would be saying about Thatcherism. And I'd be interested to know if that is what you're saying about Thatcherism, or if you're saying something else about Thatcherism, that we still have the idea of the smaller state, it's a gentler time, we have modern means to get there, we are going to rehabilitate it in gentle language. It's what I heard quite a lot of, and I think there are these two different things. But the thing, the reason I think this is interesting is I don't think there have been any outriders intellectually of the current leadership in any of the right-wing think tanks, because all of the right-wing think tanks think that what the modern right is for is less state equals more freedom. It's very easy then to say George Bush didn't reduce the state, he must be a bad person, not a real conservative. Thatcher didn't reduce the state, John has told us. Reagan didn't reduce the state. You have to say to the right, we are not here to reduce the state. Are you going to say that to the right?
Very good. Okay, thank you. Actually, I'm going to let John Crudders come back in first and then go to Oliver.
I'm nodding at the last question, actually, because I think that gets to the nuts of a lot of this in terms of that tension, that brittleness that surrounds it, which means that you don't get answers to those sort of questions. Yeah. They're swerved around. The big elephant in the room becomes Margaret Thatcher. Was she a conservative in these sort of literal sense? I was talking to someone in the gap there, and they said, well, they weren't a conservative, they were a liberal. But the Conservative Party was the best institution to camp out in with the prospect of power and access to public policy making, which is very dangerous because it gets into the other thing. If this movement is the compassionate conservative agenda, is a literal one, which I think it is, I think it's real, and I think it's meant by a number of the elements within the party, most prominently Oliver, how does that reconcile itself in terms of party management, where you have the demography of the Conservative Party, which comes out of a wholly different, its whole sort of genealogy is from a much more brutal liberal tradition, which would find an anathema, a lot of these discussions, and especially Philip's contributions in terms of re-establishing a form of conservatism, which is one with the sort of 19th century squire that looks out for those who are affected by the brutality of the market and is literally rehabilitating a form of conservatism which is more in tune with conservatism in Britain. And the exceptionalism is Thatcher, and the descendants of Thatcherism in the Conservative Party are at odds with the whole sort of genealogy of this conservatism, which you want to stamp as the sort of enduring characteristic of future conservatism. And that throws up all sorts of tensions politically in terms of process, as well as intellectually in terms of how does that relate to, you know, the fundamentals of neoclassical theory, the question of the purity of exchanges, which, you know, we see the logical conclusion with this sort of the carnage writ large in terms of global economics. And it's an inability to articulate intellectually what's going on here. And I think, you know, that gets down to really difficult terrain in terms of the coherence, which we found in Labour, actually, in terms of the radicalness of early Blair, not late Blair, early Blair, which is very uncomfortable for the whole sort of architecture of the party, its whole culture. He was a real iconoclast, less so as he went on. Yeah. But if David Brown does take... David Cameron. If David Cameron does...
I'll tell him that.
If David Cameron takes this stuff literally and believes it, he has to take it through to the logical conclusion of being quite an isolated figure in his own party.
Mm.
Right.
Yeah, well, that's, why the terminology starts to matter, because we've had compassionate conservatism, progressive conservatism, liberal conservatism. What you could say about Mrs. Thatcher is she wasn't a conservative. She probably wasn't. She wasn't a progressive on any kind of proper understanding. But she was a market liberal. But a market liberal is only one brand of liberalism, and in my view, a kind of bastardised view of liberalism is a better form.
But
of
a dominant trend in a lot, especially much younger conservatives, in terms of their own.
But market liberal is not the same necessarily the same thing as a liberal. But there is this tension, nonetheless, between liberal conservatism potentially and progressive conservatism, to the extent that it's about the individual and the state leaving the individual to its own devices. And that's Maggie's question. Comes in here as well, Oliver, about the point about the state. Actually, by definition, you want a smaller state if you're a conservative, because that frees people, whereas a progressive view would be actually the state can empower people as well, and that you should be agnostic about the state rather than having some sort of fundamentalist view about it.
We have to rewrite conservatives.
So, Oliver and Philip, you've each got 2 minutes to rebuild
conservatives. The problem about this conversation is that it's rather interesting. I'd really like the sort of next 4.5 hours to... address all of these things, and clearly your patience will wear thin long for that. I think I sort of just choose two things to talk about. One is this question which was raised just a moment ago, which you also were alluding to, which is, if you like, the John Gray two faces of liberalism question. Yeah. How do we deal, as progressive conservatives, how do we deal with the fact that there are communities which are, you know, deserve respect, but are illiberal? And how do we deal with the fact that we also attach some real importance to civil liberties in the traditional sense, that's to say the liberty of the individual to live their own life? My answer to that is an issue. It's an enormous issue, and it's a very difficult issue, which I think explains why John and his lucid book on the subject quite rightly concludes that there is no conclusion. This is a debate, a discussion, which will always go on, and where there are balancing values. I have written a book which is probably one of the least read books in the history of books. in which I discovered gradually that actually I believed in Isaiah Berlin, and I believe that there are conflicting values in society, and they go on being conflicting, and you don't ever reconcile them. And I think the group matters, and I think the individual matters, and I don't think there is a solution to this. And, you know, what conservatives do is what the Labour Party or the Liberal Party or any other party, any group of sane individuals does, which is to try and balance these things off case by case with no perfection, and constantly gets rebalanced. So I think that is a big issue, but I don't think it's an issue for progressive conservatives any more than anything else. It's just something we all have to wrestle with. There is a big debate that goes on between people whose essential instincts are liberal. John Cruddas and I guess, probably are on the same side of that debate in our respective parties, and people whose basic instincts are more authoritarian. And, you know, there's a left liberal versus left authoritarian debate, and a right liberal versus right authoritarian debate. And at the moment, it so happens that the left authoritarians have got more control of the Labour Party, and the liberal right has got more control of the Conservative Party. But there have been times when it's in reverse, and I don't regard any of that really as anything to do with the ideological positions. I regard that as much more to do with the fundamental instincts of particular individuals that happen to be in charge of political parties at a given time. Hence the ID card debate, say, which I think is, you know, it's not a surprise that Diane Abbott and I agree about it. But we, you know, we're not ideological bedfellows, but we agree about that debate. Let me come to the other question, however, which both John Gray and Will were raising in spades, and to a degree is what's implied by what John Cruddas was talking about, which is this question of whether recent events have somehow, so to speak, traumatically changed the character of English government and English society, in the sense that they have created the need for an enormously more powerful and enormously more active state. I hope I'm not parodying the position that either of you were taking. This is broadly what I think you were saying. I think that would pose a quite considerable problem for us if there were a shred of truth in it. But I don't think there is. Of course I accept the points that you were making about the fact that when you get certain kinds of crises, including this one, the state has to take certain kinds of action, and there's nobody else who can do it. And taking over large parts of the banks is a classic example. But let's just flip to Sweden for a moment. This is a country where all the banks essentially were taken over, and the state, John Gray would have described that as a huge extension of state power, and Will would have described that as a need for a vast intervention by the state, which isn't going to go away. But actually, the government of Sweden, which David and I and others have spent a lot of time visiting and talking to at the moment, is a progressive conservative government. I can't put it no other way to describe it, really. It's not in charge of the banks anymore. It wasn't the intention that it should be. And actually, I'm enormously heartened that I've listened to Labour ministers perfectly sensibly say that they do not regard these acquisitions of banks as any kind of permanent solution to anything, and that they intend as soon as possible to find ways of getting rid of these holdings. So I think that is a necessary corrective action, which is not part of the onward advance or the necessary onward advance of some great, huge central power. So I think the serious issue underlying what Will and John were saying is the question which I think Will more than John concentrated on, which is, can we defend ourselves against the winds of globalisation without a strong central state? I think that's, if I was to choose something which causes more trouble for us than anything else, it's that. And my answer to that is that actually the state is quite peculiarly unable to defend us against the winds of globalisation. Of course it can defend us militarily against global military threat to a degree. That's part of its purpose. It's probably its first purpose. But when we're not talking about that. We're talking about globalisation in the sense of commercial globalisation, financial globalisation, trade globalisation. Can this state defend us against whatever it is we don't like? And there are things that we don't like as a community about globalisation, whilst allowing globalisation, which I think both Will and John quite rightly were saying, is a necessity economically if we're to be well off, to flourish. And I think all the evidence of the past many years is that actually nation-states, or indeed conglomerations of nation-states in unions and European Union, whatever, are not terribly good at defending populations against these things and against the consequences of them. And I would argue strongly, if I had very much longer, I would start accumulating evidence for this, that if communities and people, individuals, want to protect themselves against these, the solutions turn out to be enormously localist. It's the farm shop and the community that builds its own CHP and the way in which you structure your local pub and your post office in the housing estate or in the village that are actually the defence of a certain way of life to which many of us are attached against the forces of globalisation that's effective. And those things cannot be commanded. They can't be organised by the great state. You know, we're saving our village shop in Thorncombe, and it's the in my own village in Dorset, and it's the action of villagers that's doing it. We had a little tiny bit of help from the local authority, but basically it's from the bottom up. So I would argue protection against the things we don't like about globalisation is much more from the bottom up than from the top down, and I don't think that the winds of change that we've seen over the last little while imply an enlarging and all-powerful state that we have somehow to accept and live with. I think, on the contrary, they imply the kind of programme we're talking about.
You've made it an empirical question there, though. You have said, actually, this is now an empirical question. You've said it doesn't work. It's not
yes,
very effective.
That's
so,
exactly.
So it has moved from being a kind of a philosophical standpoint, correct, a priori view,
correct,
about the size and spoke of that, and you've now just made it purely empirical question. Does it? Now, we can have a long argument about whether or not it
exactly
works, but actually you've just totally changed
it's
the
ground
on which
it's an enormously important
arguing
shift we're trying to achieve.
So you have
not
no
to talk about this in terms of dogma, but to talk about it in terms of what works.
So if we could empirically show you that, in fact, the state was
exactly
going to be successful.
Exactly.
If we could accumulate evidence of the contrary,
absolutely,
you'd be in
and
favour.
And the tip for chat is if I can show you it isn't, you'll suddenly join
but
us.
But you've made it an empirical debate. All right. Excellent. Will, Will has to come back on the farm shop thing. The farm shop's
can
all
I
all
speak to that
yeah.
Well, I thought you'd like the farm shop one, but you
I'd like to take the issue of local versus global capital first, then deal with Sundar's very, very important question second. I agree with Oliver. I think it's very clear that we need local capital in order as a redoubt against global capital. And I repeat the point I made earlier, that what we've actually done is we've created a monopoly whereby if I buy a house in Clacton, somehow it's reliant on the activities of a bank in Maine. There's something profoundly wrong with that. And actually introducing several things, engendering local organisation, protecting local capital from being securitised out to one monological system of global capital. And this is perhaps where I differ from you, Oliver. I think the state can facilitate that. I think through laws, regulation and culture, the state now has to facilitate the creation of tiered markets, of tiered levels. And I think this needs to be very radical. As I said with David, I think we need tax and investment benefits for the local as opposed to the global. Oddly enough, I think we need less regulation locally, much more regulation globally. It's very clear, it's not just kind of right-wing rubbish, it's very clear that small businesses are over-regulated to death. And it's very clear that, that there's all sorts of incentives against growing British businesses. Why don't we have the huge tranche of middle SMEs that they do in Germany and Japan that were part of their economic renaissance? Because there's all sorts of state, tax and bureaucratic incentives against it. We're a nation of one-man bands and vast corporations. What we have to do, and what the role of the state has to do, is facilitate the creation of these multivalent economies. That, I think, is a role the state plays. Now, what I think is interesting in difference, in distinction to what both John and Will have talked about is I think it would be a disaster if we moved from monopoly market to monopoly state. It would just repeat everything that's wrong with Britain, whereby our whole culture, we need to have more history. Everybody laughed when I said the Middle Ages. And that's interesting because it indicates that we have become an ahistorical people. We are now a people who can't even think back 30 years, let alone 60, let alone centuries. If we knew our history better, we'd be suspicious of both an unregulated market and an unregulated state. All that we would do, and all that's happened, unfortunately, in the present situation, is we move from market crisis to state monopoly. And then state monopoly will eventually break down and then move back again to market monopoly. That's the whole post-war oscillation. Why that's wrong is that there's nothing more disempowering of individuals and of communities than that sort of unedifying pendulum swing. We've got to be more creative. And what's interesting is it's the right that's being creative about this. And again, this is where I totally agree with Oliver. You notice Oliver said it's bottom up. He's right. I only think the state can facilitate that. And I think that what we actually have to do is grow kind of our own asset communities, our own capital communities. And I think providing very strong local associations protects us. Why isn't China in as much trouble as we are? Well, in one sense it is, because it's a demand-led economy and the whole world economy has gone to pot. But another sense is it has local capital because its banks aren't globalised. There's actually no, in the history of Britain, there's no free market economy that ever developed outside of Hong Kong without levels of protection. If we're going to develop the economy that Oliver wants and that David wants and that the Conservative wants, if we're going to rebalance the economy away from New Labour's fetishisation with big business so it can produce big welfare, we're going to actually have to introduce interventionist measures as Conservatives to shelter the growing economy that we want to grow. Rebalancing won't just happen by fiat. It'll have to happen by the same way Vietnam has grown. If you compare the growth rates of Mexico to Vietnam, Mexico went NAFTA, Mexico still annihilated. Vietnam had structured investment programs. Its growth rates are superb. In Britain, because unfortunately, the Labour Party has just levelled the country and has driven us towards, as Will said, how speculative bubbles. We're going to need to grow the economy differently and grow it diversely, and that requires thinking of state and market differently.
Okay, Philip, can I just... I need to let John and Will in, and then we'll do a round at the end. But I'll let you come back to it, but I want John Gray to come in on a specific point about the state, and I'm doing another round.
Yeah, just a few quick responses. On Sweden, empirically speaking, purely empirically speaking, Sweden in the 90s isn't Britain in 2009. We're much more severely exposed because, as Will said, the size of our property boom and the size of our financial services. So the logic of events points to a much greater state, which I think will be, with all of its dangers and inefficiencies, will be around for a long time. And I think also, I think there's a sort of, you know, there's a law of irony in politics and the history of ideas. The irony of Thatcherism was that, committed to a small state as it was, it ended up promoting a very strong, invasive, centralized state. But I can see that very same irony working in the context of progressive conservatism if it involves the state acting to transfer resources and power to these intermediary institutions, because it's going to have to be a jolly powerful state to do that, as the Thatcherite state was a jolly powerful state. And a secondary point, I mean, this is interesting, but it may well also have to be protectionist in a wide variety of ways. Is protectionism, economic protectionism, a necessary condition for the success of this political project? Now, I'm not dogmatically opposed to protectionism, but I'm pretty opposed to it now, at this moment in history, at this moment in time. It doesn't mean it won't happen. The reason is we would then be repeating some of the mistakes, some of the errors that we had. And if we did it now, if any big country then, like America under Obama, which I think he signaled doesn't want to, as it were, it would accelerate all these processes to a catastrophic extent. So the irony might be that the only way to get this society in which the state has been diminished in the progressive conservative or red Tory context maybe involve, as it did with Thatcherism, a much stronger state which doesn't even succeed in the goals that it achieves. Final point, pragmatism, which Margaret raised at the back.
Sorry, it could be local protectionism, not national protectionism.
Exactly.
Well, no, it couldn't, for the reasons that Will has... local protectionism. People produce their own jumpers, let's say, in Dorset, the Dorset jumper. They wear it, they look at each other and they can see other Dorset jumper folk. They feel a deep sense of spontaneous solidarity with each other. They don't like the non-jumper folk, a problem. They don't like the people who go to the supermarket on the edge of town and buy jumpers for £1.50. The Chinese jumpers, the Indian jumpers, et cetera, et cetera. So how does that work? What do you do about the people who might not all be poor, but some of them will be poor, who opt out of these local arrangements? Do you then say, we need the state? We've got to sort of, you know... I think the only way is to really curtail the inflow of subversive cheap foreign jumpers.
No, that's not
true. Okay, we'll come back to it. I'm going to do another round of questions on the floor, however, and then we are going to pick up Sundar's point. Don't worry, Sundar, I haven't forgotten your question. Yes, over there, Sir Kate. Gentleman there. Okay, we'll take these two. And the gentleman there as well in the glasses.
Okay. Kate Gavron. I want to go back to one of the first things that David Cameron talked about, which is his ends, fairness and opportunity. And we all agree those are wonderful things. But I wanted to talk about social mobility and ask what progressive conservatives would do, not so much to encourage upward social mobility, but also to enable downward social mobility. Because it seems to me that all the work that's gone into trying to increasing upward social mobility has failed to avoid the problem of the inability of people at the top to allow their offspring or whoever to go down.
It's true.
Yeah, opportunity hoarding. Yeah, very good. Thank you. And there's two right next to each other there.
Yeah. Not so much a question, but just a point. Surely the only point of the people of Dorset making their own jumpers is that no matter how poor you are, you don't then have to buy them from the Chinese.
It depends how expensive the Dorset ones are, presumably.
Yeah.
Nick Spencer from Theos. Relocalisation was mentioned a lot earlier on. I just have a question about it, really, which is it seems to me that advising central government to relocalise seriously is rather like asking it to soar through the branch on which it's sitting on. If it genuinely is going to do it seriously, it means devolving financial power and responsibility to the localities, which means that if that power is and money is used irresponsibly, government has to say, not my problem in actual fact, because we have seriously relocalised. I can't see central government ever doing that, because I think it'll just be hauled through the coals and the press.
Yeah. Well, John Stuart Mill, who hasn't been mentioned yet, said that everyone's in favour of devolution down to the level that they currently occupy, which is sort of a good caricature of policy. OK, we're going to come back to Sundar's question as well, but we've got Kate's point about what would progressive conservatives do to ensure that middle classes don't continue to opportunity hoard and that their children will be downwardly socially mobile. And then Nick's point about getting the sort of turkey's vote for Christmas would be a different metaphor. And then I do want to come back to Sundar's point, which is that if we're to take all this progressive conservatism stuff seriously in terms of the way it's been explained today, doesn't that almost require a kind of proper renouncement of the market fundamentalism that was represented by Thatcherism? So why don't we start with you, Oliver?
Well, let me deal with this this question of social mobility first. I think it's a profoundly pessimistic question in the sense that you're assuming that we have a sort of zero-sum game here where the size of the cake we're dealing with is not enlarging and we're simply talking about how we can ensure that one lot of people go up and another lot of people go down. I don't think that's at all the situation we've faced for the last 50 or 100 or 200 years. I don't think it's the one we're going to face in the next 50, 100, 200 years. I admit that we happen to be sitting in a few months when there is not an enlarging cake, but it's not how it's going to be over time. And over time, therefore, the question is not how do some people disappear off into appalling states of ill fortune while others rise from ill fortune to better fortune. The question is, as we share out the goodies, so to speak, of growth, how do we ensure that an overweight proportion, a significantly overweight proportion, goes to people who are currently underweight? That's our image of the thing. And I think that is, that's to a considerable degree. After all, let's not lacerate ourselves as a society. If you look at us, that's the reason I was smiling when Philip was mentioning the medieval times. You know, if you look at us over the last 500 years, we have made some social progress. It's not the case that there's the degree of disparity of income that there was. And, you know, John and his tradition has a part to play in that. I readily accept that. You know, the fact is that it is possible over time to get to closer to a situation in which people not only have opportunities but also outcomes which are more evenly distributed and in which people who find themselves at the bottom of the heap can rise and so there is a larger proportion of a larger cake. I got into frightful trouble with, I think, the Daily Telegraph when I said these things 2 or 3 years ago, but now it seems to be the norm, so to speak. We're allowed to say this now, the Conservative Party. We favour a larger proportion of a larger cake going to people who currently get too little of it. I think it was a perfectly possible thing to do. I admit, of course, there are all sorts of difficulties on the way of getting it to happen. God knows, because the present government's been trying, it hasn't succeeded very much. So, you know, clearly there are difficult issues, but it's doable. Let me just come back to the Dorset jumpers for a second, if I may, because I don't know how we got to Dorset jumpers. But there's a serious underlying issue here, and there's a point that John Gray made, and I'm an admirer of John Gray's books, as he knows, so I've given them rave reviews. But I've never heard anything I disagreed with more than what he just said about this. Of course it's the case that there are advantages of scale. Anyway, we're not trying to be Neolithic about this. Of course there are advantages of scale. And of course it's the case that people who have very little income get a jolly good deal in Tesco's. And I have recently, therefore, supported the arrival of Tesco's in Lyme Regis against some people who had sandals on and were explaining that it'd be perfectly all right if it was Waitrose, but they weren't having a Tesco's there. And I pointed out to them, the people in the housing estates in Lyme Regis want to be able to shop in the Tesco's. It's cheaper and it's better than they can get otherwise. So, yeah. Clearly, there is a scope for that kind of thing. We do not need to operate defensive citadels, therefore, against these things. What we need to do is enlarge choice, diversity. It's possible to have the Dorset jumper, which lots of people would like to have, and not to be under what Philip correctly calls the monopoly of only being able to go to Tesco's or whatever, because there is no Dorset jumper competing with it. And, you know, lo and behold, we will sometimes find that the Dorset jumper is also incredibly good value. Sometimes we'll find that the things that are done locally are more expensive. Sometimes we'll find they're cheaper. Very often, the kinds of things that arise bottom-up turn out to be peculiarly well-suited to the locality and hence to have competitive advantage. And so, you know, I think, again, we just mustn't be nearly so pessimistic. Well, this is not a protectionist thesis. This is a thesis about trying to create diversity of opportunity and scales. Part of the answer, but also niche and brand and localism and understanding of the customer is another part of the answer. And, you know, Will has written eloquently about all these things, and they can be built in.
So there's no empirical view of the state. There is such a thing as society. We have to rebuild communities. We have to help markets to sustain themselves. What's left of Thatcherism? Yeah. I mean, I think the journalists. All the journalists are gone, but I just saw one. I was going to say, take your chance. Come on now. Get off your chair. Come on, Oliver.
Let me take on. Renounce, I'm sorry, I haven't taken on the Thatcherism. John, right.
Now's your chance.
Yeah. I mean, this is a. There are various parodies around of what Mrs. Thatcher believed. She did indeed believe in various kinds of liberalism. That's perfectly true. Yeah. But in other respects, she was not a liberal. She was. She also believed in authority. And not only that, but she also believed in very profoundly in the importance of things like family. There were about 10 years of family policy groups under Mrs. Thatcher. This is not to do with market liberalism. This was to do with a profound belief in organic entities within society. And of course, she was a conservative in those senses. Yes, of course, she was also. And this is my real answer to John. She was. You know, I guess the difference between us.
Right.
Well, the difference between us, I think, is this. It's sort of underlying difference is this. I think that your image of politics is of a continuing debate. And of course, I accept that is part of the answer, but just that, between different polarities. Whereas I think actually part of the point about politics is it's a corrective to problems that change over time. And the point is that the country that there was in 1979 was, on our analysis, a country that desperately needed rescuing from a kind of grip. I know you wouldn't accept this, I understand that, of this analysis, but from our point of view, it was a country that needed rescuing from the grip of a government that was unable to govern but was over-governing, and from intermediate institutions like trade unions that were able to govern but shouldn't be. So, of course, the thrust of her activity is different from the thrust of the activity we are now engaged in, which is addressing a country which is in 2008 completely different, because, not least, the Labour Party accepted a great part of the shift which Mrs. Thatcher brought about. That wasn't because the Labour Party was totally market liberal. It was because it accepted that the British public had a centre of gravity politically which was different from the centre of gravity of our country in 1979. And you know, I think, therefore, this sort of talk about it as if, you know, you're debating about things in a sort of ahistoric way, and you're saying, now, are you a Thatcherite? It's a crazy question, are you a Thatcherite now? Thatcher was not now. Thatcher was in 79. She was addressing the problems of 79. We're addressing the problems of 2008. They're different, they require different solutions, and that is likely to be the true in 2038. There'll be another set of Conservatives with another set of agendas that address what it's like in 2038.
And they'll be asking, are you a Letwinite?
Yeah, well, they won't, but a Cameronite.
All right, we are way over time, so I'm going to ask the three remaining panellists to offer us their closing thoughts. And Sunder hasn't got his scalp yet, but perhaps Philip's prepared to do his renunciation.
Mrs. Thatcher's a mixed legacy. That's what I honestly intellectually think, and she had different positions that were mutually contradictory. So you might say, for example, that she was a distributist around council housing. She gave people property and assets and wanted to finance the people giving property and assets. The only thing wrong with her council house policy, she didn't continue it. She didn't have like a ring fence idea in which gradually home ownership built up. That's not a liberal policy. That's a Tory distributist property extension policy. Another thing is Mrs. Thatcher certainly wouldn't have been in favour of the credit economy. She was a monetarist. She believed in sound money. The only time in which she would license the increase of the monetary supply would be now, but she certainly would be wholly against the entire mechanism that brought it about. I think what really I would really say intellectually is I don't think Mrs. Thatcher understood capitalism. She certainly didn't understand what the abolition of capital controls would bring about. She certainly wouldn't have been in favour of credit, debt finance leverage. She comes from a small shop owning class. She wouldn't be in favour of 45 times your asset-based leverage. So I think there's a sense in which she understood kind of the needs for a market. And I think modern conservatives, as I've said, I'm in favour of the market mechanism, but I want it embedded in a society leading to social goals. And I think that that mechanism is much more in line with Tory thinking. The Tory thinking I'm in favour of extends from Cobbett, Carlyle, Ruskin, through Richard Oster, Sandler, Wilberforce, Disraeli, Randolph Churchill, Winston Churchill, Eden, Macmillan. All of these people taught this is a legacy. So, and I think Mrs. Thatcher and Chamberlain himself really could draw the link between Thatcher and Chamberlain. And Chamberlain himself had some wonderful ideas about reviving cities. His idea of introducing local markets actually is what revived so many of Britain's cities. So it's about the place of the market and its role.
Okay, thank you. John.
Well, I mean, again, we'd need hours and hours to dissect.
days, weeks months.
To dissect Mrs. Thatcher, I just make one point. The one thing she definitely was a progressive.
That's true.
She was a market liberal. She believed very strongly in progress. I mean, one slight bit of evidence for this, although it's slightly mixed, is she said she was greatly influenced by the writings of the late Professor Hayek. I remember having dinner with him when she said that. In other words, he was still around, although he was in his 80s and 90s. And, of course, as John has said, the last chapter of Hayek's book is called Why I'm Not a Conservative. So she was a hybrid, but all practical politicians are. And here I agree strongly with what Oliver Letwin has said. It doesn't really make sense to say, are you a Thatcherite now? I mean, this is 30 years later. There's no communism in the world. Apartheid's gone. We have globalization on a vastly greater level. We're in a fundamentally, there are continuities, of course, but it's changed profoundly. It really doesn't make any sense to say yes or no to that question. So I think that's important. Final point, though, I think this issue of globalization is significant because I still don't think, you see, when we talk about, back to the Dorset jumper, God knows how we did get on that. But it's quite feasible, I think, for a larger sphere of people's consumer activity to be sort of conducted in local and regional contexts. What I think is a lot less feasible is for their producer activity to be conducted in, as workers, in other words, in local contexts. Because so much of our economy is linked to, I mean, we don't have much of a manufacturing economy left, we might not have much of a financial economy left, short, but I mean, so much of it is linked with global markets. So I just can't see how one can have a fundamental relocalization of employment without cutting some of the links that sustain globalization. And although I think that globalization has had many negative features, more than is commonly admitted, I don't think it's feasible or desirable. And I don't think it's actually going to happen short of a global disaster of deglobalization, that we will cut ourselves off from it. Actually, if you look at longer history, and I agree with both Philip and Oliver on this, we should look at the longer history. Britain has been, at least since the repeal of the Corn Acts and so on, has been perhaps the most globalised economy in the whole world.
All the wool trade.
Sorry?
All the wool trade.
I mean, we've been like this for 150, 170. We're just not going to do it. It's not going to happen. Whatever else happens, that isn't going to happen. So what we've got to try and do is provide some elements of safety, back to David's four goals of progressive conservatives, which would be shared by people in other parties. And where I think the key thing is, I do think that in our present context, not perhaps to the same extent, to a greater extent that might have been true in Sweden 15 years ago, or in our present context, I can't see how that can happen without greater state involvement there's been in the past, even though I recognize fully that many of the things that the state will end up doing won't work. Final, just kind of contingent point. When I asked, we're muddling through all this. We will muddle through all this, both the economic, the financial, and even the social and the cultural aspects. We will, in fact, muddle through. But if there's been some big mistake in the last 6 months, 9 months in muddling through, what was it? I think it was probably letting Lehman's go down, because that put a panic throughout. Now, if I'm right about that, they should have had a more consistent kind of view in America. Now they've got gigantic stimulus, probably not big enough, huge intervention. They're exposed to problems as we are, but in a different way, that the rest of the world, which continues to lend them money and buy bonds and whatnot, will conclude this is only going to work if there's inflation, our assets will be worth less, kind of problems there. But if they'd pursued a policy of non-intervention, which Congress seemed to want and lots of ordinary Americans seemed to want, and AIG, say, had gone down, what would have been the result? The result would have been mayhem in the markets, and probably, let's not forget this, in less deeply stable political societies than Britain, unrest, civil unrest. What would this have done in many parts of the world? So there really is, it's the logic of events. Maybe we don't want to start from where we are, but that is where we are.
Okay, thank you. Will, could you brilliantly, wittily, and pithily synthesize all that?
That's a drink. Yeah, I mean, I, I just don't, you know, there hasn't been a, I mean, I think some of the stuff that Philip has done in particular is kind of sort of straw women and men have been set up, Philip. I mean, I don't recognise in my own thinking or any of the people who have inspired me, influenced me, this kind of, you know, advocacy of the monopoly state as a counterpoint to the market. I mean, I think there's always been a deep interpenetration of market and state. And this is my objection to, or not objection, my point I'd make to Oliver. I mean, I'm a Keynesian, and I've been a Keynesian since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, converted when I worked in the financial markets in the 1970s. And the big point is that the big point about Keynesianism is that financial markets and the real economy are in a kind of existential tension. Finance moves to different rhythms. It has enthusiasms and periods of despair. It moves more quickly. The interest rate can't actually do the business of bringing it into alignment with the real economy. It has to be regulated, and it has to be, the state, you cannot have a system where banks actually have their deposits guaranteed by the state, and the people who run banks are then free to bet those guaranteed deposits on anything they like. And, you know, but it doesn't, it's not a kind of thing that will go away in 7 or 8 years' time, as it has in Sweden. It's a continuous and ever-present fact about the way capitalism happens. And consequently, if you look at the FTSE 100, there isn't a company in the FTSE 100 who hasn't one way or another had its franchise developed by the state. In fact, Margaret Thatcher was rather good at doing that. She privatised lots of them. That's how she created Vodafone brilliantly by giving it free its radio spectrum and allowing it to build radio masts without seeking planning permission. The state acted to build one of our great companies, and she was quite right so to do. And in that sense, you're quite, she was conflicted. But my big point is this, is that progressive conservatism seems to me, if it doesn't take head on the fact that actually there's going to be the state, and the state and the market have an ongoing interdependence, then actually it is chasing for kind of will-o'-the-wisps to look for kind of local solutions and no taxation. And, you know, even the example you gave of, you know, villages and communities, they look to the post office. Well, you know, the post office happens to be a state institution. John has actually advocated, a post office bank. I think that's a very good idea.
So have you.
I mean, you know, but this is the deployment of the state.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, of course. So I mean, progressive conservatism, you know, if it's to make more headway and to develop a viable economic philosophy to sit alongside some of the interesting social recommendations it makes, has got to get real about taxation, about the use of state power, about the creation of public institutions, and not resile from that, or to shout, you know, along with people like Simon Jenkins, it's all about decentralisation. Of course, there's an element of that, but, you know, we've got to have the state. That wasn't very witty, but I've got it said.
Don't worry, Will. Thank you to John Crullis, widely tipped as a potential leader of the Progressive Labour Party. Will Hutton has a book on the way entitled Sweet Justice. John Gray's new book, Gray's Anatomy, will shortly be on the shelves. Philip Blond's book, Red Tory, will, I'm sure, follow soon after that. And Oliver Letwin wrote a book a long time ago entitled something like Perhaps Isaiah Berlin Was Right After All, which didn't sell very well, but is still available from good second-hand bookshops. We're going for a drink. Never forget that the difference between networking and not working is only one vowel. So I don't mind which you do. Please join me in thanking our panel. Thank you.